dirt laden. When a master chastises his servant, the servant should accept this as great mercy. One who becomes angry must be very foolish not to know that such is the duty of a friend. Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is said that when a foolish man is instructed in something very nice, he generally cannot accept it. Indeed, he actually becomes angry. Such anger is compared to the poison of a serpent, for when a serpent is fed milk and bananas, its poison actually increases. Instead of becoming merciful or sober, the serpent increases its poisonous venom when fed nice foodstuffs. Similarly, when a fool is instructed, he does not rectify himself, but actually becomes angry. Paramo nugraho dando vritteshu prabhunarpitaha balonaveda tattandi bandhu krittam amarshanaha. My dear slender maiden, when the master chastises the servant should accept this great mercy. One who becomes angry must be very foolish not to know that such is the duty of his friend. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Parastaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakti Vidanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pucharine Nirvishesha Sunyavari Paschachare Sitarine Om Gyanam Timuranda Shoganjana Shilakaya Chaksuna Miritam Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Trupischa Kripasindu Bivaja Titanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So here, a foolish person is described who cannot recognize that danda, the punishment, paramo anugraha, is supreme mercy from the master to the servant. Don't see it's for their benefit and instead becomes angry. Prabhupada gives a little discourse on the nature of a fool. It cannot be corrected. So Prabhupada, also as a spiritual master, sometimes rebuked and chastised his disciples, and sometimes he refrained from it. He did not do so because he could see that actually this devotee isn't advanced enough to receive a rebuke. They'll simply become angry and become offensive. So therefore, I'll be very nice, deal with them very nicely. But actually, to somebody who is more advanced, Prabhupada would sometimes rake them over the coals very severely. And Prabhupada himself mentioned how at one point he was rebuked by his spiritual master. I don't know how well I remember the particulars, but Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was giving a lecture. And Srila Prabhupada was in the audience. Somebody asked him a question like, what time is it or something like that. And Prabhupada turned to answer. And Bhaktisiddhanta said to him, Abhai Charan, if you think you can talk better than me, come up here and give this lecture. Something words to that effect. And Prabhupada said, I knew then I had received my spiritual master's mercy. So this is how he took it, that this rebuke in public, too, this public rebuke was, you know, Prabhupada said, well, I was just answering his question, you know. He asked me, you know. One could go through a trip like that, but he didn't do that. I said, I knew I received his mercy. Prabhupada gave us he had the same understanding here in this verse, that this chastisement from a superior person is actually should be accepted as mercy. But as he says, a foolish person cannot accept this. I want to spend a little time discussing foolishness because it's a worthwhile discussion, since basically the whole world is moving on foolishness. What is foolishness? I think what we see as foolishness is a deep, obdurate, obstinate, incorrigible stupidity. It is stupidity that is incapable of correction. It says in the Bible, in the book of Ecclesiastes, as the dog returneth to his vomit, so the fool returns to his folly. Another will do the same stupid thing over and over and over again. So sometimes we can recognize easily people like this. They get cheated in business. They invest in some foolish scheme, you know, and everybody says, no, no, you'll get cheated. I know what I'm doing. And he does it, you know. He loses all his money. So they say, well, maybe he's learned. But again, same thing, you know, again. No, no, this time I know what I'm doing. This is different, you know. It's not the same as the last one. And foolishness in business, we always end up being recognized because these people end up losing their money. But sometimes it's not so obvious when somebody is being foolish. But this is the characteristic of it. They cannot learn from experience. They cannot learn from... Here they're being chastised or rebuked by somebody who knows what to do, and instead they just become angry. Go away, I know what I'm doing. There's a famous story in India, you know, told about Kalidas, that the ministers were set out to... They wanted to humiliate or to humble a proud princess and were looking for the stupidest man in the kingdom. Who ended up later as Kalidas, the great poet, but in the beginning he started his career as the stupidest man in the kingdom. So they saw a man sitting on the branch of a tree and sawing off the branch between himself and the trunk. And they said to him, wait a minute, stop that. You know, if you saw that branch off, you're going to come crashing to the ground. He said, leave me alone, I know what I'm doing. He kept on sawing, and sure enough, he came crashing to the ground. They looked at him, he said, you must be a great astrologer. And they said, that's our guy, you know. He says, leave me alone, I know what I'm doing. You know, this is recognizable. So, but when we see when this keeps on going, people don't learn from their experience, this is foolishness. And I've had occasion myself to make a study of foolishness. As a person who was trained in academics in the university, and these are people who are intellectuals, and you begin to notice the huge degree of foolishness there is among intellectuals. And this becomes a problem, the stupidity of intelligent people. Why is it there? How can they be so smart in so many ways, and yet at the same time be so foolish? Because I noticed this. I was a philosophy major, and I noticed these people were brilliant. And actually, I had a problem because I was clearly outclassed by these people. And you'd hear somebody give a brilliant argument for some position. You say, well, that's a brilliant argument, and he smashed all his oppositions. You know, maybe that's the truth. And then somebody else would come along and just trash it. You know, apparently even more brilliant, smash it. And you think, you know, well, this must be it. And then somebody else comes along. And they keep on going. And I realize, you know, what am I going to do? You know, first of all, I'm not on that level. And second of all, these guys just keep trashing each other all the time. How are you ever going to come down? So then I decided I'd try another test, and I looked at these different professors, and I thought, well, you know, I'll do this test. If I accept your philosophy, then I'll become exactly like you. Do I want to do that? And I looked at their lives, and they were disasters. They were absolute disasters. Now, so many were alcoholics, and I mean, I don't want to go into the description now, but... And there, a little while ago, there was a book published by a guy named Paul Johnson, who wrote a book, historian, of the European traditional conservative sort. And this book is called Intellectuals. And he looks at progressive intellectuals in European thought, beginning with Rousseau and going up to Bertrand Russell and Sartre.
And these are people who have all been boldly prescribing, you know, the things that are going to cure mankind from their ills and straighten up human society, Marx and Freud and all that. Looked at all their personal lives and showed what total disasters they were. It's quite an interesting book. You get a kind of wicked pleasure from reading it, but it's still quite revealing. So how can people who are smart, I mean, their minds work fast. They're able to handle a whole lot of data. They learn many different languages. They read lots and lots of books and absorb it. And yet, ultimately, they end up defending, you know, Marxism for years and years and years, and you know, so many foolish causes. And in academics, you see it all the time. It's mind-boggling. I was happy to see, you know, the other day. I read one academic described academics as a herd of independent minds. Because that's the sort of how they work. Everybody's going along the same way. They're all, this is what we do now, and they're running along. And just like a herd of stampeding animals will suddenly just turn for no reason. They go off in this direction. Now we're going in this direction, and then for no reason, they turn. You can't see where the signal come from or who the leader is, but all together they turn, go in that direction. This is exactly the behavior. And if you put forward certain proposals, their most devastating answer is, we don't do that. We don't do that anymore. That's not done here. That's it. You know, it's more like you've committed, you know, like you say, maybe evolution is wrong. And you bring it up in certain circles, they look at you like you've passed air at a dinner party or something, you know. Or you've used the wrong fork. It's a breach of etiquette. And that's the most devastating argument. And you, oh, okay. You're just a cow and you're part of the herd, you know. So the stupidity problem needs to be considered. And also in ISKCON, we see simply by becoming a member of the Hare Krishna movement, foolishness does not go away. So what is it? And first of all, if we look at the idea of how people who are intellectuals, what we call intelligent, I'll call it clever. They're very clever on the mental platform. And how somebody can be clever in this way and still foolish is actually explained by Vedic understanding that higher than the mind is the buddhi, is intelligence. It's not on the mental platform. So people can be very clever on the mental platform and still on the platform of buddhi be foolish. They're different platforms. Prabhupada has said like this, that in human society we see, he describes four different cultures. The culture of the body, the culture of the mind, the culture of intelligence, and the culture of the soul proper. The culture of the body is going on, restaurants, swimming pools, nightclubs, all the different things do for the enjoyment and taking care of the material body. Then there's the culture, and people think this is the highest thing, the body, taking care of the body, enjoying the body, keeping the body fit for sense gratification. Then higher than that is the culture of the mind. And Prabhupada says these are the universities and the colleges where people put forward, for play with different ideas for mental speculation and accept and reject them. This is what he describes this as. He says the culture of intelligence is the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is actually about the culture of intelligence, buddhi. And you'll notice in Bhagavad Gita, all the time, and it practically becomes synonymous with devotional service, is buddhi yoga. Because when buddhi, actual intellect, is fully developed, you surrender to Krishna. Because Prabhupada explains in Bhagavatam that intelligence, when it's properly functioning, is the form in which the super soul gives us direction. And that when our intelligence is actually properly developed and reaches its fulfillment, we surrender to Krishna. Then the culture of the soul is Srimad Bhagavatam, because Bhagavatam begins where Bhagavad Gita leaves off. Bhagavad Gita finishes with, you should abandon all religions and surrender to me. And Bhagavatam takes up, Dharma Projita Kaitavo Atra Paramo Nirmatsara. Now that you have given up these Kaitava Dharma, these contaminated or materialistically motivated religions, now you're ready for Srimad Bhagavatam, which is for those who are spotless. So these are the different platforms. So it's interesting that he describes Bhagavad Gita as the platform of intelligence, because we can see that that people who are called intellectuals, very, very few of them actually understand what buddhi is, or intelligence is. And it's this failure on the to understand intelligence that accounts for the foolishness of otherwise clever clever people. Now, I think we get good instructions from Prabhupada. So let us look at what makes us stupid. What are the causes of stupidity? And especially that obstinate, obdurate, incorrigible stupidity we call foolishness. And the answer is, as it turns out, it's sense gratification. This is why it's so hard to cure. It's sense gratification. And that sense gratification actually influences our intellect. Scholars sometimes tell us that there's a difference in ideas of why we are fallen in the world. The Platonic tradition and generally the Jnani traditions say that the cause of our bondage is ignorance and the cure is knowledge, whereas theistic or personalistic traditions say it's sin or disobedience to God. Actually, they're the same thing. They're just two different sides of the same coin. It's sin, that is to say, disobedience to the injunctions of the Lord, which make us stupid. And Krishna explains this in the Bhagavad Gita very clearly. The result of sense gratification is ultimately that you acquire a false ego, and false ego means you become proud, and pride is really another name for stupidity. Any jiva that is proud is ipso facto stupid and cannot take instruction. You cannot take instruction. You cannot recognize a superior. Ultimately, that superior we have to recognize is Krishna. Prabhupada once said, don't be puffed up. Remember, you're dealing with Krishna. Anytime there's pride, we've forgotten we're dealing with Krishna. We've forgotten who we are. But again, it's sense gratification which is at the root of this thing. I want to direct you to a couple of verses in the Bhagavad Gita where Prabhupada describes what happens with intelligence. Now, intelligence, buddhi, is described in the Bhagavad Gita when Krishna says, I'm situated in everyone's heart, and from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. In other words, the facility to forget Krishna is ultimately comes from the Supersoul directing the attention of the jiva away from Krishna. See, there's a phenomena in perception of attention. We come into a room, and some things we see or notice, some things we don't notice. Some things are interesting, some things are not interesting. Some things are significant, they're not significant. What determines interest or attention? Attention is actually directed by intelligence. And so there's no such thing as pure perception. Perception is always there because you notice certain things and don't notice other things. And intelligent people often find out that they were wrong for years and years simply because they didn't notice something that was right in front of their eyes. Their theory caused them not to pay attention to this. And now we discover that this is actually very important, and now I have to have a new theory which accounts for it. Because perception, knowledge, is theory-driven. And your theory is a scheme which directs your attention into certain areas. This is important, this is not important, this is significant, this is not significant. So the direction of our attention in certain ways is actually governed by intelligence, and intelligence is governed by the supersoul. When they want to forget me, I disappear. They cannot see me. I vanish from their sight. When they want to remember me, I suddenly show up everywhere. They notice me. They notice me. So here's this in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, text 69. What is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled, and the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. The difference between day and night. The one who is Krishna consciousness lives in one world, and the one who is not lives in another world. We say it's day, and they say it's night. What they see is night, we see is day. What's going on? Well, how does this happen? And Prabhupada explains. Prabhupada gave a lecture on this, which was transcribed and published in a booklet. First thing I ever read by Prabhupada, a little booklet called Who is Crazy? We say they're crazy and they say we're crazy. Who is crazy? So listen to how Prabhupada comments on this verse. He says, there are two classes of intelligent men. One is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification, and the other is introspective and awake for the cultivation of self-realization. Activities of the introspective sage or thoughtful man are night for persons materially absorbed. Materialistic persons remain asleep in such a night due to their ignorance of self-realization. The introspective sage remains alert in the night of the materialistic men. So this is the difference. There are two. Notice how it says there are two classes of intelligent men. So when people have directed their attention and all their aspirations and their endeavors towards sense gratification, that means their intelligence is pushing them in this way. So they're alert and interested in the activities of sense gratification. But the other group, the intelligence is going in the other direction. They're alert for sense gratification. They go into, it's just like you say to describe people, our four regular principles. They say, what do you do? If you don't break the four principles, you obviously, that's night for them. You know, nothing's going on. Nothing's happening here. And we may walk into some place where people are engaged in sinful activities, and there's nothing of interest going on to us. You know, we're not fired up. Everybody else is looking at this meat rolling around on the grill, and we think, I got to get out of this place, you know. It's night and day. So notice how Prabhupada, this is how intelligence is working. And ultimately, this intelligence that is directing towards sense gratification, that's bad intelligence. It makes you, ultimately is the cause of foolishness. So later on, Krishna explains to Arjuna, who's wanted to know, even if you know better, even if you're trying, why is it that you become attracted to material activities? You're impelled to sinful acts. Even though you know they're sinful, still to some force that pushes you, and Krishna says, it's lust. It's lust. It's kama. And so then Krishna remarks, he says, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence, meaning here, indriya, mana, and buddhi. So using these precise terms, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence are the sitting places of this kama, this lust. Through them, lust covers the real knowledge of the living entity and bewilders them. So they become bewildered, vimohayanti, stupid. So Prabhupada, here now stupidity is being described very, very accurately by Krishna. So Prabhupada says, the enemy has captured different strategic positions in the body of the conditioned soul, and therefore Lord Krishna is giving hints of those places, so that one who wants to conquer the enemy may know where he can be found. So see, first of all, you have to want to conquer the enemy. If you think this enemy is your friend, you know, you're just condemned to stupidity and foolishness. Because what is the foolishness of the world? They engage in sense gratification. They suffer. As soon as they get out of the recovery program, they go right back to it. There are so many different ways. They do it. They suffer. And as soon as they get back on their feet again, back to it again. Right? What have they learned? So where can this enemy be? So if you want to take, and you understand that taking direction from Krishna, from Prabhupada in this Bhagavad Gita, this means now we are taking good intelligence directly from the Super Soul. Now, he's directing us in this way. So if we've got anything going for us, we follow. He says, mind is the center of all activities of the senses. And thus, when we hear about sense objects, the mind generally becomes a reservoir of all ideas of sense gratification. It stores it up, impure reminiscences, memories, desires, stories, tips of good vacation places to go, where the girls are, where the boys are, whatever it may be. So this becomes the repository, a reservoir of all ideas of sense gratification. Think of the mind in this way. And as a result, the mind and the senses become the repositories of lust. Because then the senses become eager to enjoy. Next, the intelligence department becomes the capital of such lustful propensities. Because as soon as the mind and the senses are agitated, then the intelligence becomes, the attention goes to that direction, and you become focused with all your goal-directed activity on sense gratification. That's how the intelligence becomes captivated. So it becomes the capital for such lustful propensities. Intelligence is the immediate next door neighbor of the spirit soul. Lusty intelligence influences the spirit soul to acquire the false ego and identify itself with matter, and thus with the mind and the senses, the spirit soul becomes addicted to enjoying the material senses and mistakes this as true happiness. There it is. There's the analytical study of stupidity. This is exactly what happens. Notice how he says, now the intelligence becomes directed in this particular way, and now it influences the spirit soul to acquire the false ego. What is this acquiring of a false ego? The false ego is the idea that I am the enjoyer and I am the controller. And also the other side of this is I am the body. And so with both these things, ideas in mind,
this way the spirit soul forgets its real identity and thinks that because the soul is looking for satisfaction of the self, as soon as the self is identified with the material body, then I think that the self will be satisfied by satisfying the demands of the body. And therefore, I head off in this wrong direction, where everything I do to make me happy actually increases my misery. This is the foolishness of the world. Samsparsaja Bhoga, Krishna says, those pleasures which arise from the contact between the senses and the object, dukkha yonaya evate, they are in fact the source of all suffering. So let us consider now for a minute, what actually is sense gratification? Let's do like a little phenomenological study of the act of sense gratification. Krishna describes it, samsparsha, that you contact between the senses and the object. So let us say, here's a sense, right? Like my hand like this, like a claw, and here's the sense object, right? So the sense come into contact with the object, latches on, and then bhoga, there's a feeling of pleasure. Now, so far, I think you don't have sense gratification, because you could bring your senses together with the object and there could be a feeling of pleasure, but you could tolerate it. Just as sometimes you bring a sense together with an object and there's some pain, and you may have to tolerate that. So similarly, there's heat and there's cold, you know, and you know, whatever it may be. But actually what happens when sense gratification is there's a further movement that takes place. We put our senses and there's a feeling of pleasure, and then something else happens and we think, now I'm enjoying. Right? We think I am the enjoyer, now I am enjoying. And then we also think, this is mine. Right? I am the enjoyer, I am the owner, I am the controller. In other words, this act of taking possession of a sense object as mine for me to enjoy, I puff up. And therefore, because what really is going on in the deep depths of my soul is I'm thinking, I'm God. I'm the enjoyer. I'm the controller. And that's why, so implicit in this act of sense gratification is the acquiring of a false ego. The fact of the matter is, you cannot enjoy in the material world without acquiring a false ego. That's why Prabhupada says human life is meant for self-realization, and then he stated the corollary, and not sense gratification. You know, they're inversely proportional. If you imagine, you know, a scale or an old-fashioned hand balance, you know, like the sign of Libra. You still see them in India, you know, the scale, or in chemical laboratories sometimes. So, if on this hand I have self-realization, on this hand I have sense gratification, inversely proportional means that when self-realization goes up, sense gratification goes down. And if sense gratification starts to grow up, self-realization will go down. It's like this. It's not that this is going to happen, that they'll both go up together. If anyone tells you that'll happen, he's a cheater. He's a cheater. And so it's to Prabhupada's credit that he didn't cheat. He's not a bluffer, he said. They asked him, how are you different from these other gurus? Prabhupada said, I am not a bluffer. I'm telling the truth. This is the truth. Sometimes people don't want to hear this truth. They want to cheat. They want self-realization and sense gratification at the same time. We should understand this, that they don't go together. Because as soon as we try to enjoy in this world, we become entangled. We acquire the false ego. We identify with the body. whatever happens to the body we think is happening to ourselves, and Krishna disappears from view. This sense gratification is really the act of atheism. All the seeds of atheism are in there. Even if we are regulated in our sense gratification by piety, still Krishna's at a distance. You stay over there and just make sure you're supplying me with my sense gratification, and, you know, because you want it, I'll follow a few rules and regulations. But you don't have a relationship with Krishna. You kept him at a distance. You know, you're still the center of enjoyment and he's the instrument. So even that is not good. And of course, Krishna is particularly talking about this. So one should understand that this addiction to enjoying the material senses, then he says he mistakes this as true happiness. It's not happiness. People will say to you, "You're trying to tell me I'm not happy?" I've had somebody say this to me. Of course, when you actually acquire the taste for Krishna consciousness, immediately you can understand this is not. But philosophically, you should understand that this dukkha, this suffering, is implicit. Because as soon as you identify yourself with the material body, then everything that happens to the body you're going to experience as happening to yourself. It's not enough just to believe you're not the body. You have to experience yourself as not the body. That experience is not available as long as you're trying to enjoy in this world. And whatever happens to this body, you'll experience, this is me, this is happening to me. You cannot be detached. You cannot be detached. We cannot do this on the mental platform. Oh, I'm not the body. That doesn't free you from the bodily conception of life. You have to put it into action by understanding where our actual happiness resides and where our actually happiness is. So at least we should understand this. If I should understand that any contact between the senses and the object as the nature of the case in this world, it's temporary. I bring them together and they're separated. I spend my time in this world establishing various relationships. By those relationships, I experience some pleasure. I have to work very hard to maintain these relationships because they have this distressing tendency to break apart in the material world. But ultimately, I cannot perpetuate these relationships, even while I have them in anxiety. And the ultimate failure to perpetuate our relationships is called death. Will you solve the death problem? You know, so even in your heart, you know this. You know this, you cannot solve the death problem. You haven't taken into account. Therefore, even while you're enjoying, you're full of anxiety. You have to work so hard. Maybe the flow of money is going to stop. Maybe my girlfriend is going to get attracted by another man. I mean, there's so many different ways. Everything can fall apart. And so I have to work so hard and suffer, even while I'm so-called enjoying. So it's not enjoyment. So we should understand this. Krishna says that we have to become free from envy. The first thing is that we cannot be resentful of the injunctions of Krishna. He says in the same chapter, chapter 3, this is text 31, those persons who execute their duties according to my injunctions and who follow this teaching faithfully without envy become free from the bondage of fruitive activities. But those who, out of envy, notice the word envy has been repeated here, disregard these teachings and do not follow them are considered bereft of all knowledge. Here stupidity comes in again. Huh? Bereft of all knowledge. Befooled. Vimudhan. Vimudatma. Ahankara vimudatma. Befooled. And ruined in all their endeavors for perfection. So what is the initial problem will be envy. Envy of Krishna's position. Envy that I will not follow his orders. Prabhupada says this very interesting commentary. He says, there are many philosophers who write comments on the Bhagavad Gita but have no faith in Krishna. They will never be liberated from the bondage of fruitive activities. These are the smart people who are stupid and who comment on the Bhagavad Gita and remain stupid all the way through. They never hear Krishna. But an ordinary man with firm faith in the eternal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute such orders, becomes liberated from the bondage of the law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord, but because one is not resentful of this principle, that is, that the injunctions of the Lord ought to be followed, but because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada's take on this without envy is without resentful of this principle. Now this purport, these remarks at the end, is actually is because Prabhupada thought in shlokas. This is actually from the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a verse there. This is 11th canto, text chapter 20. This is text 27 and 28. Jata Shraddho, Krishna's talking. Jata Shraddho Matkatasu Nirvina Sarvakarmasu Veda Dukatmakan Kaman Prityage Api Anishvaraha Tato Bajeta Mam Prita Shradalur Dridda Nishchaya Jushamanas Chitan Kaman Duko Darkams Chagarhayan. This describes actually the beginning stages of Krishna consciousness. Jata Shraddha Matkatasu. This person is one who has his faith in the narration of my glories has been awakened. Jata Shraddha Matkatasu. So he has faith in hearing about Krishna and Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Nirvina Sarva Karmasu, and is actually disgusted with material activities, all material activities. Veda Dukatmakan Kaman. They know all sense gratification leads to misery. I mean, it's very strong here that the Atma, the soul of Kama, is dukkha, is misery. They know this. So these are the qualifications. They have faith in Krishna's katha. Krishna, they have faith in Krishna katha. They're actually disgusted. They really want to become free from all material activities. And they know very well that it leads to misery. Yet, parityage api anishvara. Still, they're unable to renounce all sense gratification. We've found ourselves in this position, I'm convinced, and still somehow or other. So what do we do then? Krishna says, my devotee should remain happy, is what he says, and worship me with great faith and conviction. He says this. He says he should be pritaha. Tato, thereupon he should worship me, bhajetamam pritaha, and be happy. In other words, do not become depressed and discouraged. Even though he is sometimes engaged in sense enjoyment, my devotee knows that all sense gratification leads to a miserable result. That's repeated again. And he sincerely repents of such activities. So, dridha nishchaya, he should remain resolute. He's shradayalu, he's faithful, and Dridha Nishchaya, his convictions are resolute. He knowing that all sense gratification leads to misery, he garhayan, he repents. So it's not that I say, okay, you know, I believe in Krishna, so it's okay. No, one should actually repent. So in this way, one can make progress. So this is, I'll read the verse, the translation again. Having awakened faith in the narration of my glories, being disgusted with all material activities, knowing that all sense gratification leads to misery, but still being unable to renounce all sense enjoyment, my devotee should remain happy and worship me with great faith and conviction. Even though he is sometimes engaged in sense enjoyment, my devotee knows that all sense gratification leads to a miserable result, and he sincerely repents such activities. Now again, let me read Prabhupada's, what's actually a purport to this verse in Bhagavatam, put down as a purport to text 31 in chapter 3 of the Bhagavad Gita. Although Prabhupada never says where he got it from, it's clearly where it comes from. He says, but an ordinary man with firm faith in the eternal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute such orders, becomes liberated from the bondage of the law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord, but because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. So this pritaha, work sincerely without consideration of defeat and hopelessness. So these are the qualifications that one needs to progress. So even though, of course, it's hard to detach ourselves from sense gratification, we're all addicts for many, many, many births. It's understood that this is a gradual process. But the qualification is that if one follows this, as Prabhupada has said, then this detachment will come. And as that comes, then the stupidity goes away. The stupidity gradually disappears. And we can hear good intelligence coming from the Supersoul. We become determined to follow Krishna's. Society of brain, so we can actually be correctly guided by the real brain, who's Krishna, who's ready to give us all intelligence and just waiting for us to become receptive. Here are the instructions how to get a brain. We should follow them. Any questions or comments? Yes, D. Moody. You have to have another identity, right? In the spiritual world, it's clear that Krishna's God, and I'm not. Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. That's what happens. But the propensity for sense gratification is the propensity to be an enjoyer like Krishna, an independent enjoyer. Prabhupada said, somebody asked Prabhupada, Swami, what is the meaning of life? You know how people go to a guru and say, what is the meaning of life? They did that once early on, and Prabhupada said, the meaning of life is to enjoy. So it is not that we are not against enjoyment. We're all, you know, anandotropic, bliss-seeking entities. But we have to know how to enjoy. And we enjoy by... Prabhupada says that a devotee has no other way of experiencing happiness except by seeing that Krishna is happy in all respects. That's how we actually enjoy in connection with Krishna. Separated from Krishna, there's no enjoyment. There's no life, actually. To connect with Krishna, all life is there. We have to know this. Yes. Sure. Well, let me just comment on that. It's true. And in the mode of goodness, knowledge is possible. But the material mode of goodness is characterized by a thread of ignorance running through it. And so basically the whole material world is running on ignorance. And that's why Lord Shiva is Maheshwara. He's the Lord of this world. Because the foundation of the whole material world is the foolishness of all living entities. They're all foolish. Even in the mode of goodness, there's a thread of foolishness. That's why we have to become transcendental. That's why he has to become free from Kaitava Dharma ultimately. You may get aboard on some cheating position, but you have to come to the non-cheating point. I don't think it's actually a kind of cheating, but it's just understanding that some people will not be able to hear. And so for those who cannot hear, Krishna also says in the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes you can't disturb these people. And so for them, you have to say something else. So some accommodation is made for all kinds of people to somehow or other get headed in the right direction. But that has its downside. As Narada Muni explained to Vyasadeva, you simply encourage them. You've reproduced the karma kanda portion of the Vedas, and you've given a license for sense gratification. They'll take the sense gratification and forget your restrictions. That's the downside. So everything has its downside. That's something I've learned in this world. Even mercy has its downside. Prabhupada said, my mistake was I initiated too many unqualified people, you know. He accepted it. So that's mercy, you know. But we're glad he had the mercy, but it has its downside. So similarly, the Vedas also has this allows for compromised religion. But you're supposed to come to the platform, and especially because of the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, people can come very quickly to the highest. The highest platform. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you over there in the corner. My neck doesn't turn this far anymore. After the age of 55, you know, there's a limited mobility there. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a generosity of spirit that people need to have. Sure. If falling down or making a mistake is not considered to be the worst thing. It's falling down, making a mistake, and not repenting and not recognizing it and not making progress. If somebody is making progress, then they're good. The measure of whether somebody is good or bad should be a dynamic one. Are they earnestly trying to become better? As long as that's there, we should accept them. Nobody is bad who's not earnestly trying to become better. And I think that's what we look for. And if somebody is trying, has made a mistake, has recognized it, is trying to become better, we have to appreciate them. Even if we cannot appreciate the person for what they are now, that person is now, we should be able to appreciate from what they're sincerely trying to become. Otherwise, maybe sometimes there's something of a fault-finding mentality, and a fault-finding mentality is just means that. That I'm really worried about myself, but I'm not being honest, and therefore it's deflecting it, projecting it, my worries on everybody else. The man who's really lustful is going around saying, "Oh, he's looking at women, and he's looking at women, and he's looking at women." You can see that he's really worried about himself, but is not really not able to confront that. So we have to become the first qualification. Of a Vaishnava, Prabhupada quotes Bhaktivinoda Thakur saying, is simplicity, sarlata. The opposite of this is duplicity. So simplicity means we have to be arjuna, straight. You have to be honest with yourself. And at the same time, so free from that fault finding, that we're honest with ourselves, then you'll also be able to not look at the fault so in such a worried way of everybody else. These are the kind of considerations, at least I have on this matter. Krishna consciousness is. You've seen so many people go through so many ups and downs for so many years now, and. If anyone's still practicing, that's great. That's great. I know when we were young, you know, we thought, okay, this is a cinch, in 5 years I'll be a pure devotee. So now we know better. We have a little bit of wisdom about these things. And one should become, you can become magnanimous and tolerant of people without lowering your standards. People are afraid as soon as we become a little magnanimous, then we're lowering our standards. That's not the case at all. It's not the case at all. But sometimes it's very hard to have very high standards and still be a human being. Now, I have this saying about ISKCON. I told this to a Catholic priest. He says, yeah, it was the same with us. My saying is that you strive very hard, you practice Krishna consciousness, you strive so hard, and finally you make advancement and you become a pure devotee. Then you make even more advancement and you become a human being. So we have to become human beings. Which means have a certain generosity of spirit. And recognize what people are going through. And when they're sincerely trying, as is recognized in these verses. So we should give them all credit. Okay. Yeah, last one too. Yeah. Sure. A foolish person is... That's exactly the sign of it. Because, see, the thing about foolishness, if I'm foolish, the scary thing about foolishness is obviously, by definition, you don't see your own foolishness. It's really obvious to other people. But to yourself, you don't see it. Because as soon as you see it, then you're not foolish anymore. Now you're like, oh, I'm a fool. You know, that's the beginning of wisdom. And you say, I can make mistakes. I better be careful. Then you know something is happening. So of course it's that way. So the person is wise. This is the whole thing that Socrates discovered. You know that he would go around to these so-called sophists, these wise people, and he says, I don't claim to be wise at all. But all I can discover is everyone else is, when you start to question people who claim to be wise, the claim is not based on anything. All I recognize is that I don't know. I'm foolish. And so that's the actual wisdom. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Yeah, I see that in the current.
Yeah, I know. I see it all the time.